Today's episode of the Can Be Now podcast is brought to you by Gustafson Insurance, business, home, and auto insurance made simple. For a free quote, call 503-266-2216.
This episode is also brought to you by Canby Signs and Graphics, creative geniuses, state-of-the-art technology. If you need something printed on anything, visit them today at canbygraphics.com.
This tax exemption eludes me like a gazelle eludes an arthritic cat.
Why can't Canby people keep track of their dogs? Like, what is...
To do that, you can't be stupid with guns.
Yeah. Set the board is saying they want to make Canby schools great again.
It feels like we've been doing this interview for years.
Inside of me was screaming.
You run for school board, you win or you die.
There's no second place. Welcome to the Can Be Now podcast.
We are the best and easiest way to stay connected to what's happening in your hometown. I'm Tyler Franke.
I'm James Walton.
And I'm Tyler Clausen.
The roles of teachers and parents, especially when it comes to the needs of LGBTQ students, became a topic of lengthy discussion last week at the Molalla River School Board meeting. Dozens of teachers, parents, union reps, and community members crowded in, promoted by a controversial proclamation passed by the board at its previous meeting. The controversy stems more from the group that originated the resolution than the resolution itself. A nonprofit called Parents, Rights, and Education, or PRIE, PRE, it describes its mission as protecting and advocating for parents' rights to guide the education of their children, and seems to focus on the topics of sex education, LGBTQ issues, and students' access to contraceptives. The group promotes a conservative and traditional approach to these subjects and opposes the comprehensive sex education curriculum required by the state of Oregon. The school board's proclamation, based on the model drafted by PRE, declared November Parents Partnership in Education Month and appeared aimed at simply recognizing the important role parents play in their children's education. However, not everyone saw it that way. Molalla River Middle School teacher Jeff Claxton called PRE a, quote, anti-LGBTQ organization and said that the proclamation equates to, quote, supporting the group's ideas and goals, thus creating an unsafe and unwelcoming place to work and learn for everyone.
We are all different, and we each have our own view on things, and that's to be celebrated. That's what makes this country great. We don't all have to be the same, but we do have to treat each other with dignity and respect. People and organizations who do not do that have no place in this district. Bigotry and hate have no place in this district. And turning your backs on students and employees because of who they are has no place in this district. Please rescind your proclamation.
He concluded by asking the board to rescind the resolution, a request that was echoed by several others. Another commenter, Nicole Higginbotham, read a statement from her sister Michelle Lowe, a counselor at the middle school and the advisor for the student-led Gay-Straight Alliance, the Equality Club. The statement was addressed to Board Chair Linda Eskridge, who had presented the original proclamation and who had been quoted in a 2018 post on PRE's website criticizing the Equality Club.
You refer to homosexuality as a lifestyle and a state that students may identify as LGBTQ to gain newfound attention and peer acceptance. Your statements imply that gay-straight alliances are about students discussing gay sex instead of what they really are, a place to connect with other students and be accepted for who they are, whether they identify as gay or straight. I am deeply offended and appalled that you would make such unfounded claims and accusations. I do not talk about or promote sexual activity to any student, whether gay or straight.
While many of those who spoke echoed Claxton's and Lowe's statements in opposing the resolution, the board was not without supporters. Brianna Sagdahl, a Molalla resident and candidate for the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, said she does not enroll her kids in public schools, but that the school board's resolution made her consider changing that stance. She was so excited when she read it, she said.
I don't understand why the school feels it has the ability to provide a safer place for their children than us parents do. Us as parents are the safest place for our kids. And the fact that the staff, that the teachers union would say that that somehow violates a contract or some sort of social contract, it really boggles my mind. And so today I stand with our school board, and I want to say thank you, because this is a very difficult scene to make. And all it is simply saying, we support your parents. They're supporting us.
After public comment, the board members took turns sharing their thoughts. Director Craig Loughridge said the board made it very clear last month that their adoption of the resolution did not mean they were aligning with PREE or any other group. He admitted to being disappointed by the response and even expressed bewilderment that the board could be accused of being anti-LGBTQ.
I don't see how you can take exception with affirming the right of parents to be involved in their children's education and upbringing. Please tell me where in here it says this is against LGBTQ students.
Right.
Point it out. I don't see anywhere where it mentions that. I don't know where we got off on this weird tangent. When I was looking at this, that was the furthest thing from my mind.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about parents and whether or not they should be involved.
Director Mark Lucht said he supports parents' rights and involvement in their children's education and believe it's something that most teachers and community members support as well. He said he would not vote to rescind the proclamation unless the community comes together to present an alternative. Finally came the board's student liaison, Natalie Litchfield, a senior at Malala High School and an amazingly poised and well-spoken young lady. Here's what she had to say about parents' rights in education and what she believes the limits should be.
Frankly, if parents have the right to just decide what their kids can and cannot learn on a high school level, I think that that is pretty scary. I want parents to be involved in the education. I want my parents to be involved in my education. I want them to know and support what I'm learning at school, but I don't want them to control it. I'm 17 years old, and I think that I'm capable of deciding for myself what to do with the knowledge that I'm given, and I know that I'm not alone in that.
The board ultimately voted to continue the discussion at this week's work session scheduled for 7 p.m. today, Thursday, at the Malala River School District office located at 412 South Swegel Avenue. For more in-depth version of the story, visit our website, canbenowpod.com. A temporary stay of Governor Kate Brown's 180-day ban on flavored nicotine vaping products has now been made permanent, pending a judge's final ruling in the case. The order by Appellate Commissioner Teresa Kidd came down last week in two cases against the Oregon Health Authority, one of which is being argued by the Canby law firm Tyler Smith and Associates. Ryan Adams, a partner in the Smith firm, received the temporary stay last month after filing an emergency petition. Although the appellate court has not made a final ruling in the case, and it's anyone's guess as to when that might happen, the order did express Commissioner Kidd's belief that the petitions were, quote, likely to prevail in the case, and that this weighted heavily in her decision to make the stay permanent. She also cited petitioners' arguments that the ban on flavored nicotine vaping products, if it were allowed to go forward, would have a, quote, immediate and devastating effect on the state's estimated 4,000 vape shops, most of them independently owned small businesses. In her order, Kidd wrote, "If the rule is enforced, they will lose their businesses entirely within weeks. Their employees will lose their jobs. In addition, one petitioner explains if they are forced to close their shops, the businesses will lose their leases and potentially be on the hook for tens of thousands of dollars in rent that they do not have. Indeed, the petitioners assert that the enforcement of the rule will cause the entire industry in Oregon to be destroyed." Petitioners had also argued, and Kidd seemed to agree, that if the state were successful in enacting this ban, it would have far-reaching consequences, giving the, quote, almost unlimited power to ban products. In petitioners' view, Kidd wrote, it would mean that the Oregon Health Authority could ban any product it believed created a public health issue. Gas-powered vehicles, aluminum foil, coffee, cell phones, alcohol, salt, butter, and margarine. It now appears very unlikely that Governor Brown's ban on flavored nicotine vaping products will go forward. The only way that if it could is if the courts rule in the state's favor before February, when the order is scheduled to expire anyway. Brown's order imposing the ban had followed a widespread outbreak of acute lung injuries linked to both marijuana and nicotine vape products. More than 2,100 cases have been reported across the country, with 42 deaths, two of them here in Oregon. The Aurora City Council voted last week to appeal the Oregon State Aviation Board's recent decision approving updates to the Aurora State Airport Master Plan. The master plan is important because it is a critical prerequisite for the proposed 1,000-foot runway extension that supporters say is needed to safely accommodate the numbers and classes of aircraft currently using the airport. The runway extension is opposed by the cities of Aurora and Wilsonville, the land use advocacy group Friends of French Prairie, and a number of area residents who fear it will bring larger, louder aircraft and more of them. The master plan became an issue months ago when Oregon Aviation Director Betty Stansbury wrote in a letter to the Friends of French Prairie that the board had never approved the 2012 master plan. However, she retracted that statement in a later letter clarifying that the master plan had been adopted after all. The Aviation Board held a meeting on October 31st and affirmed Stansbury's position, concluding that the 2012 master plan had been approved by the state 8 years earlier in October 2011. The decision was heralded by supporters of the runway extension, like the Aurora Airport Improvement Association and its president, Bruce Bennett. "The board's action was affirming of everything we've been saying," Bennett said in a press release. Quote, "The master plan process was a good process, that the proposed runway extension is a necessary safety improvement, and that the master plan with the proposed runway extension meets all the state land use goals and will not infringe on local farmland," end quote. The city of Aurora, evidently, was not convinced. Filed on November 14th, their challenge to the State Land Use Board of Appeals, commonly known as LUBA, joins an appeal already on file by Friends of French Prairie, as well as a motion to intervene by the city of Wilsonville. Bennett, the Aurora Airport Improvement Association, Tony Helbling, and the Wilson Construction have filed their own motions to dismiss the appeal by the Friends of French Prairie, as well as Wilsonville's attempt to intervene. Opponents contend that there are no final orders, minutes, or any other records that verify the approval of the 2012 master plan. Furthermore, Friends President Ben Williams says an audio recording of the October 2011 meeting, which he obtained through a public records request, does not include the adoption of the final Aurora Airport Master Plan, even though the Aviation Board says it did. If this is confusing the heck out of you, don't worry, you are not alone. It's an extremely complicated case involving multiple layers of federal, state, county, and local government, multinational corporations, as well as local businesses, land use interests, neighborhood associations, and small farms. Believe it or not, it's not easy to explain in a 3-minute podcast segment. Sorting out the mess will fall to LUBA for the time being, whose decision could come any day now, or it could take months. One thing we do know, the fight is far from over. Once a cat, always a cat. Tony Kraus, Canby native and former star on the Cougars football team, has been named to the All-Northwest Conference second team for his defensive play at Linfield College in McMinnville, home of the Wildcats. Kraus, a senior defensive end, helped the Wildcats allow the fewest yards and points per game of all NWC squads. Kraus was an All-Northwest Conference first teamer last year after leading the Wildcats in sacks. This season, he accumulated a career-high 26 tackles, including 6 tackles for a loss and 4 sacks, third most on the team. At Canby High, he was a 3-time All-Three Rivers League first-teamer on defense and twice on offense. He was also named All-State on both sides of the ball, including a first-team award as a tight end. Congratulations, Tony. So, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? No one knows. But I can tell you, if you go onto protected forest land to harvest trees or other products without a license, you may get arrested. That happened to 2 men recently who were stopped by Marion County deputies on Highway 22 near Staten, carrying approximately 3,800 pounds of fir boughs that they had illegally harvested from the Willamette National Forest. Though the men may have just been planning to make an epic Gates of Mordor-sized wreath for their personal use, that's not what they told the deputies. The 2 men, Jose Lucas Lucas, 42, and Juan Lucas Perez, 31, said they planned to use the branches commercially and making holiday decorations. They were cited for unlawful cutting and transport of special forest products, and their illicit harvest was seized. Though piling 2 tons worth of tree branches onto a standard pickup truck is slightly unusual, Marion County Forest Patrol says that every holiday season they find folks heading into the Willamette Forest looking for a free Christmas tree. Police say the illegal harvest and sales of special forest products is a continuing concern that threatens the natural beauty of the state's outdoor recreational areas. Examples of special forest products include Christmas trees and boughs, cones, bear grass, salaw, and firewood. Illegally harvesting forest products are commonly used commercially in the creation of decorations, floral displays, or shipped overseas.
Police beat for the week of October 15th through the 21st. All right, let's see. On the 15th at 6:58 a.m., report of a theft of an unlocked vehicle overnight. 7:15 a.m., report of a hit-and-run traffic crash after a vehicle backed into a stopped vehicle in a parking lot and then took off. So that's fun. At 9:11 a.m., report of a theft from 2 unlocked vehicles overnight. At 11:26 a.m., report of another theft of an unlocked vehicle overnight. Holy cow, somebody went on a spree! And at 11:49 a.m., report of an unknown person rummaging through a parked vehicle but did not appear to have anything stolen. At 1:47 p.m., report of a dog at large. I almost read a large dog. Nope, it was a dog at large, just running around, and the officers were able to corral the dog back into its yard and contact the owner. On October 16th at 5:34 p.m., a report of an attempted identity theft when a potential victim learned that an unauthorized credit inquiry had been made using their identity. On October 17th at 8:09 a.m., report of a theft from an unlocked vehicle overnight. It's starting back again. At 3:03 p.m., report of a person making threatening remarks while inside a store. Officers located the individual and notified him that he had been trespassed from the location and could not return. At 9:01 p.m., an intoxicated man was arrested for disorderly conduct. On October 18th at 11:50 a.m., report of the theft of a wood stove from a residence. That is very specific. Why would you steal a wood stove? I don't know. At 5:40 p.m., report of a person trespassing on private property. Officers stopped the man and seized a weapon that was unlawful for him to have based on his status as a convicted felon, and also advised him that he had been trespassed from the location and could not return. On October 19th at 12:05 a.m., officers responded to a report of 2 males fighting outside of a bar and took 1 person into custody for disorderly conduct. At 9:30 p.m., following a traffic stop, the driver and his passenger, both under the age of 21, were each cited for possession of alcohol and marijuana. On October 20th at 3:17 a.m., an officer attempted to stop a vehicle speeding over twice the posted speed limit. The vehicle was located several minutes later, abandoned. The vehicle had previously been reported stolen. Finally, on October 21st at 6:51 p.m., a woman was stopped and advised that she had been officially trespassed from a store. After store employees suspected that she had concealed unpaid items in her bag. With the woman's permission, the officer seized and safely disposed of several needles, drug paraphernalia, and drug residue that she was carrying with her.
Are you a small business owner or maybe thinking of investing in yourself with your very own startup? Awesome! Now all you have to do is reach potential customers at a time when consumers have never been more fragmented, more distracted, or more difficult to reach. If that sounds hard, believe me, it is. That's why I make Frankie do it.
Carrie and her team at Promotional Strategies offer strategic, purposeful solutions to build your brand with lasting promotional items that make sense for you and your company. They are creative geniuses who will deliver advertisements that people actually thank you for and will use every day. We've tried other sellers, and we trust Carrie to provide high-quality branded items that we can be proud of. Find them at 695 Southeast 1st Avenue in Canby or online at ps266swag.com. Hey, Tyler.
Yeah?
Can you do me a favor? Just real quick, name all the services that you're subscribed to.
Okay. Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu. There's like
Google stuff, I think. My wife, I think, does a cat thing, and I'm looking into Dollar Shave Club.
It's starting to get a little ridiculous, right? There's even an app to manage all of your subscriptions now. Of course, it comes with its own monthly convenience fee. It can get a little overwhelming. They've even coined a term for it, subscription fatigue.
If you're being hit with subscription fatigue blues, we have a solution for you, at least when it comes to streaming options. Try Easy Video TV from Direct Link. It offers your favorite shows and movies all in one app on the same bill as your internet service.
Direct Link is a local community-based provider that has your back. Record your favorite shows, watch them anywhere, and access all the major local and cable TV networks with an Easy Video subscription.
Why are we still sitting here? How do I sign up? Let's go!
Well, it's easy. Just call DirectLink at 503-266-8111, visit their office at Juniper and 2nd, or go to directlink.coop to switch to Easy Video TV today. My guest on the Canby Conversation today, I'm so excited about. I've been nerding out for several weeks now. He's a former Major League Baseball player for the Boston Red Sox, Oakland Athletics, and Cincinnati Reds. He's one of the central figures in the best-selling book Moneyball and the 2011 film of the same name, where he was played by Chris Pratt. He was born in Salem, where he grew up, but for at least a few years as a young man, he lived right here in Canby. It's Scott Hatteberg. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, good to be here, Tyler.
Thank you so much for taking time out to do this for us. Like I said, I've been nerding out for quite a bit about this conversation. So,
I love it. Let's talk. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so my first question is, when people meet you in person, Scott, are they disappointed that you don't look like Chris Pratt?
Yeah, you know, I get that a lot. I get, you know, it's,
you don't say.
It's funny you say that. No, he's turned into Mr. Superhero guy, so he's tough to keep up with.
He is, yeah, that's hard. I mean, you guys kind of met earlier in his career, and then he just hit that trajectory, and it's just like, man, how am I supposed to catch up to that? Like,
Exactly.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though, like, that almost didn't happen, right? Weren't you originally cast to play yourself in that movie?
Yes. Yeah. Good digging there. Originally Steve Soderbergh was the director. Oceans movies and Traffic. And his vision apparently was to have everybody play themselves, with the exception of Brad Pitt, who was just going to play Billy Bean. But the rest of us players, even my wife included, were going to play themselves. You wanted this kind of realistic thing, and. Yeah, so we were there for a week or so before they ended up pulling the plug and going with the new project.
Oh, they actually had you out to the set and everything, like ready to go?
Oh, yeah, they were suiting you up in costumes. I was getting my hair cut all crazy, and, you know, I mean, you were doing all the stuff, and, I mean, it was hours before they were supposed to roll cameras that they ended up pulling the plug on it, yep.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel about that? Were you disappointed, or you're like, oh, thank God?
Tyler, I was so nervous. I can't even tell you. I was so happy when they pulled the plug. I mean, I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to pull this off.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, Steve Soderbergh, he was a pretty bright dude. And I thought if anybody could have done it, he could have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you think of old Chris Pratt's performance? It's got to be weird to kind of see someone on screen pretending to be you.
Yes, it was definitely weird. I was kind of around a little bit. Then, you know, we were on set, so we kind of had a feel of where it was going, and you meet the director, and you see some of the scripts and stuff. I thought they did a great job. I mean, you got to put a little Hollywood in it just to make, I mean, it's kind of a movie based on stats, and kind of a boring team, really, as far as people following it.
Right, they didn't win the World Series and all this stuff.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So they had to put a little stuff, but they stayed pretty true to everything. They made our manager out to be a little bit more of a villain than he was. Mm-hmm. We all really liked him. Art Howe, great guy. Mm-hmm. We didn't pay for Cokes in the locker room, but outside of that, it was pretty realistic.
Pretty realistic. Cool. Well, yeah. I was chatting with one of your old buddies from here in Canby, or at least he said he was. We'll talk about it, but Kevin Lang, and he said he felt like Chris Pratt did a really good job of capturing your swing. He described you as kind of having what he called a unique swing, and he thought Chris Pratt kind of nailed it. What did you think about that?
Totally funny, but Kevin Lang, oh yeah, he was that was my buddy
back
in the day. Yeah, so yes, he was right. Chris, I hit left-handed. Chris Pratt is right-handed, So he had to learn and go through. I mean, it took him months. He was hitting with the SC hitting coach for months, trying to mimic it and, you know, make it, because it's an unnatural, his unnatural swing. So, and I remember asking Chris on set, you know, how it went, because I wasn't there for that night.
Yeah.
And he said that no matter what happens, the director told him, whatever happens, if you hit it, just fake like it's going out of the ballpark, right? So the right. first swing, you know, and they got all these people in the stands, he swings, completely explodes his bat, and that's the scene that they ended up taking in the movie. But yeah, he gets jammed bigger than life, breaks his bat, and supposed to play it off like it's a home run, and I thought he did a pretty good job.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of like that realistic surprise, because you don't necessarily expect to hit it when you're not a professional baseball player. So.
Right. Yeah, right.
Well, let's talk about your time in Canby. It was a few years from about age 10 to freshman year of high school, as I understand it.
It was more a couple years I was there. I was there, I think I left in seventh grade. I think I was there for like fifth to seventh.
Okay.
Moved around a lot as a kid. But yeah, right there, fifth grade to seventh grade was about, I think I was 11-ish, 12, right in there. Yeah.
I think most people agree, though, fifth to seventh grade, those are the most important years, like by far, for any athlete. Yep. You know, I mean, I've heard that a lot. So.
Hey, I don't know. I tell you what, I was lucky to be, you know, as a baseball guy, and they had a really good program. They had this, it was called like the Kiwanis or something, I think was the summer team. And anyway, it was, it was pretty competitive. So we had a great coach, Lynn Kraxberger was his name. And
yeah,
I have great memories there.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, this was one big thing I wanted to ask you about. One of the key storylines in Moneyball, obviously, is your conversion from catcher, the position you'd played all through college and high school and the majors, obviously, to first base. Your last season with the Red Sox, who drafted you, you had surgery to repair a damaged nerve in your elbow, and it impacted your ability to throw, which is obviously a really important part of being a catcher.
Right.
But before that, you know, a lesser known story, I guess, was your conversion from shortstop to catcher. This is what I've been told, and that happened right here in Canby. Is that true, that you actually started playing?
Oh, my God. you got all the scoop. You got all the dirt. Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
When it comes to Moneyball catchers, I am like top dog, man.
I love it. No, that's great. Yes, it's very true. I remember, I think we were in Aloha, Oregon in a tournament, and our catcher got hurt, and I remember our coach bringing us all to the mound and like, anybody here, you know, you didn't have a backup catcher, anybody here, you know, want to catch? And at the time I was playing shortstop and had zero interest in catching, but I go, well, you know, we wanted to win this game and nobody was really volunteering, so I said, heck, I'll do it. And I had a catcher's glove at the time that I would just play with at home, and my dad had it there and brought it out, and gosh, the rest is history. I kind of liked it. You were into everything, and you know, I took a little bit of a natural feel to the position, and you know, it worked out perfect.
That's crazy. So you literally like didn't have any interest in the position. It was just like, okay, I'll do it for this one game, like, and that ended up becoming your career.
And thank God it did, because you know, it's just, as a shortstop, to make it to the big leagues, it's, you know, you got to be an insanely blessed athlete, and I mean, you're got to be so gifted, and I just don't see myself, or the way I ended up physically, being that guy. So catching, I mean, I checked those boxes way better than I did as a shortstop. So yeah, it was, nobody wanted to catch back in the day, though. You had to carry the gear around that, you know, 20 seasons worth of people have worn, and, you know, it stinks, right? And it's dirty. And so, there was a kind of a grunt element to it, but I'm glad I stuck with it.
Had you ever even, like, tried it before that game? Like, other than just playing around at your house, like you said?
No, absolutely not. Nobody did. I mean, catching was not something you put the, you know, you put the worst guy back there, you know, in the pickup game.
Oh yeah, so let's make Scott be catcher. He sucks.
Right, exactly.
Love it. Well, I have another bone to pick with you from Kevin, because in Moneyball, I remember, and I've read that book like four or five times. I love that book. One of the things is that your favorite player growing up was Don Mattingly.
Yep.
And that's not how Kevin remembers it. He said you were a big Steve Garvey fan.
Oh, no. He's a good – that's a good one. I tell you what, you know, when I knew Kevin, it was probably Steve Garvey. But then a guy named Don Mattingly entered the league, and man crush. Love that guy.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Loved his slang, loved everything. But Kevin's right on. Okay. I agree.
Okay. Back then, it might have been true. So we won't hold Kevin as a liar, so.
Yeah, no, he's right on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us just a little bit more about kind of those memories that you have from here in town. Like I said, I talked to Kevin. He's, you know, said just you guys were good friends, loved hanging out with you. You're a great guy on the team, and you played different sports as well, that you guys would do baseball cards and stuff like that.
Yep. So growing up, I you know, my dad, he worked for a Del Monte. And so honestly, it was like, you know, preschool, kindergarten, kind of move, first, second, move. Third, you know, I kept moving. And it was basically the Northwest, Vancouver, blah, blah, blah. But once I landed in Canby, it was the first time I really had met people that I, you know, were really good friends with. And Kevin was one of them. I mean, I would have considered him my best friend back then.
That's cool.
And so having to move from that point, that was the hardest place to move from. I just loved it. I had great teachers.
Yeah.
And a good group of friends. And then the sports thing was really taking off. It was the first time I got to play on a really competitive, you know, baseball team. But, you know, we played basketball together. We played everything.
Yeah.
I think we played soccer back then. It was before football. But, it was the first place I really felt rooted. And it was tough. It was a tough one to leave.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Back then, like, did you think I might, you know, do this professionally or, you know, I'd love
no.
I mean, every kid
yeah.
probably has that dream, but, like, that it wasn't realistic
for
you? Yeah.
No. I mean, I was such a fan, and yeah, obviously it was a dream, but as far as those guys were in another world, I was a junior in high school and had zero, I didn't even think I was going to go play college ball. I mean, I just, it wasn't, things for me, I was always a smaller guy, and it wasn't until my senior year in high school where, you know, things kind of clicked for me, and I had, you know, I had a big year, and some offers came in, but yeah, it wasn't until then that I actually thought, well, maybe I could even do this at college. Professionally, it was still, you know, far-ranging dream.
Wow, that's funny because, like, you hear a lot about your college years. You went to Washington State. You played with a number of other guys that went on to the majors, John Olerud, I believe.
Yep. Well, college ball, I started, you know, things were clicking. I you know, the game started kind of like I was figuring some things out. I got a little bigger. And it was then that I thought, well, gosh, maybe I can get drafted, you know. I was drafted out of high school, but I just thought, oh, my God, this is so far. I'm not ready for this. So yeah. I didn't sign and ended up going to Washington State. But, yeah, it wasn't until that time that I thought, well, maybe I'll get a shot at playing.
Cool. And that was the right decision because you ended up going in the first round when you did leave college.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Got to play for Team USA. Yep, Red Sox, right? So it was a lot of good things. Those 3 years of school really, really helped.
Yeah, that's great. And I think you said, I mean, maybe not in these words, but it's all thanks to your time in Canby. Like, it all draws back right to that.
Well, I think we can all see that. Pretty straightforward, right?
Well, yeah. Well, we're going to not keep you too much longer, but I'd love to hear, you know, a little bit more about your time in the majors. Obviously, like, there's the movie, which we've kind of talked with, a little bit Hollywoodized. The book, I know, and I said I love that book, but I know some people still, like, Michael Lewis, the author, he had a certain storyline that he was trying to create as well, and I know some people that were featured in that book, either, you know, on a larger scale like you were or a smaller scale, didn't necessarily like or agree with the way that they came out, especially maybe some of the physical descriptions of certain players, not in your case, but the creature and, you know, different nicknames that supposedly folks had. But did you sort of feel like when you read the book, I presume, or saw the movie, did you kind of feel like, for you personally, like, yeah, I think they kind of nailed who I was at that time?
He did. I mean, I spent so much time with Michael Lewis that summer. I mean, it was months and it was daily. So I still keep in touch with the guy. He is one of the most brilliant guys that I've ever met. I mean, he's a true genius.
Yeah.
And he's written so many other great books, but I remain friends with him. I work for Billy Beane right now. We're good friends. He changed this game. And I know people don't agree with some of the, the conclusions they draw as far as analytics, but analytics has just spilled over to all sports.
Yeah,
it's completely changed. So that part I've enjoyed being a part of. It's, if even just being a pawn in the whole thing, that's been cool. As far as the the characterizing some of these guys as, our assistant GM at the time is named Paul DePodesta, and right. He gets zero credit. And this guy was a genius when it came, but they didn't like the way he was kind of a computer nerdy portrayed in the book, and they ended up changing
Harvard
his
grad,
name.
Harvard grad, never played baseball.
Sport athlete. You got to meet this kid. This guy's a stud. I mean, he was a brilliant guy and very athletic. And gosh, I wish people knew his name better, because this guy is, he's working for the Browns now.
He went into football. Yeah. Talk about obviously professional athletes of any sport are, incredible athletes and incredible physical specimens. But to go to football, I mean, that's kind of where you get the real big guys.
He's a really smart guy, and it's too bad he didn't get his due in the book. But he just didn't like the way he was described. And then Jonah Hill played him, and he didn't like that. And anyway. Right. You got to put a little hot sauce on this to sell some tickets. So I'm with it. As far as my character, I didn't go around telling people I was scared the ball was going to be hit to me. But I definitely thought it.
Right.
to make the character, I think, a little more appealing, or at least to come across as far as the true feelings, you have to do it. So right. I took it with a grain of salt.
Right, right. And that was your conversion to first base, where it's like, you're playing a position on the biggest stage of your sport for the first time in your career. I
was
terrified.
So scared. I can't even tell you how terrified I was. I faced Barry Bonds. I was the first one holding the guy on, and he hit a ball. So it was like a golf ball coming at me, and I couldn't get my glove up in time. It was like I was underwater, my reactions. And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do. It haunted me for as long as I played.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
It scared the crap out of me.
We'd be doing obituary of Scott Hatterberg right now instead of an interview.
You're right.
It'd be like, in memoriam, he lived in Canby, he died.
Killed me. Yeah. Yep. Oh, geez. Yeah, I survived, luckily.
Cool. And tell us just a little bit about what you do now. You work in the Oakland A's front office.
Yeah. So, I'm a special assistant. I do a lot with our draft. So the draft is a big focus of what I do. So kind of February to June, I'm trying to see the top 100 kids in the country and put them in order. That's kind of what I do. And then I do a lot of
rank them all by on base percentage and just pick the top ones.
Hey, we got some smart guys in there, and we got some old salt baseball guys.
Okay.
We have plenty of meeting in the middle type of argument.
Gotcha.
But we're represented on both sides. So that has been really interesting and really fun. And talk about hard. How about hitting a baseball is hard. Picking kids out to in baseball for the draft is near impossible. That's been fun.
That's a great
learning experience.
Well, that's my favorite chapter of the book is the draft chapter, and I've heard that from other people as well. That's a really fun chapter, and it does show that sharp dichotomy between the old baseball and the new analytics approach. So that's going to be fun to be able to spend a lot of time in there doing that.
Yep, it's a ton of fun.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for taking time out from your busy schedule to talk to us, reminisce with us a little bit. I'm so glad Kevin wasn't lying that your career did start here in Canby. That's such a cool story to have that happen here. We just really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it. That was great talking, Tyler. It was good reminiscing.
Hey, Tyler, did you know that the world has changed in the past 20 years?
No way!
Yep, it's true. The way people shop for goods and services has completely changed since this thing called the internet started catching on.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And yet some realtors still offer the same old services in the same old ways and for the same old percentages. Victory Point Property Group in Canby believes it's time the real estate business caught up with the times. They'll meet with you for free, explain every step of the process, give you a clear game plan, and even let you choose the listing commission.
Really? They let you choose their commission?
Really? Victory Point Property Group understands this is one of the biggest and most exciting decisions of your life, and they'll do everything they can to make sure you handle it like a rock star.
Wow, that sounds great. I'm going to check them out by calling 503-263-4700 or by visiting online at victorypointhomes.com.
You do that. Victory Point Property Group, real estate reimagined.
So I'm here with Derek Hill, president of Advantage Mortgage in Canby. I was wondering what's going on in the mortgage industry right now.
The mortgage industry is on fire right now. The big thing that's really exciting for us is that we are now an independent mortgage broker, which means that we can offer substantially lower rates and lower fees for our customers. For example, we just got a loan last week, and the realtor said, hey, I think you should go talk to Derek at Advantage Mortgage. And sure enough, we got the borrower 3/4 better rate, and we saved him 14 grand in fees.
Cool. So where can people find you?
So office number is 503-266-5800, or they can find us on the web at findtheadvantage.com. But most people just give us a holler or they stop in.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Derek.
Yeah, bet. Advantage Mortgage, NMLS number 1770599. Derek Hills, NMLS number 50183. Equal housing opportunity.
All right, joining us on the line now is a voice that many of our listeners should recognize. It's our own Joy Struby. Hi, Joy.
Hey, Frankie.
Hey, welcome onto the Canby Now podcast. Such a rare treat for you.
Thank you. I know, right?
But you're actually coming to us in your role as the Canby Design Lab lead for Clackamas County. And I want to start by asking you to explain what that means.
Correct. Thank you.
Because it sounds, and it is cool, but it sounds like amazingly cool. It sounds like you're working with like Superman or something.
Ooh, I wish. Next best thing. I mean, Clackamas County is pretty great.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll give a little context. In August 2019, Clackamas County launched its first ever Community Prosperity Design Lab in Estacada, Canby, and Milwaukee. And so it's funded by the county, and it's part of a coordinated community effort known as the Clackamas Community Prosperity Collaboratives. And basically, we're aiming to bring stakeholders to the table to come up with innovative solutions to poverty and food insecurity in our area.
Cool. And those Canby and the other communities were picked, I assume, because of the needs that are here.
Correct. And so the county decided to focus on these three communities, both because of the levels of income inequality, so the gap between the rich and the poor in those communities, as well as existing partnerships and ability to gain meaningful traction. So it's actually pretty great. It says a lot about Canby that we were selected, not just because of our levels of income inequality, but the county really sees our community as one where we could make meaningful change and progress.
Mm, that's really cool. So this is something that's just getting started. You're kind of creating this thing and finding out what, you know, what the effort is going to be like and how to, because I mean, when you start talking by income, you know, about income inequality, it's one of those things. It's like a lot of people can get on board that like that's an issue, but the solutions and sort of how to get there is so complicated. There's not, I mean, if it were easy, it would have already been fixed, right?
Correct, which is why it's so great that the county is wanting to fund this in three different communities. And so every community actually has their own lab made up of locals, and that effort is being supported because there you can't have a blueprint design that will work in every community, because every community has its own strengths, its own challenges. And so it's great to just have that opportunity to say what will work for us as Canby.
Cool. Well, there is an event coming up in a couple of weeks that's going to be at the county offices in Oregon City, and I was hoping you could, it's open to the public. There's some really cool stuff happening that I think folks would be interested in here in Canby. I was hoping you could tell us about it.
Yes, absolutely. So on Wednesday, December 4th, we are going to be hosting an equity training called From Surviving to Thriving. And equity, for those of you who don't know, is making sure every person has what they need to thrive. So this involves ensuring access to resources as well as eliminating barriers. So we are bringing in a wonderful leader named Aaron Jones from the Seattle area that does great trainings on how to connect your story and personal experience with the story of what's happening in your community. And so we're hosting this at Clackamas County in the Development Services Building, and we're actually offering two sessions so that people can choose whether an afternoon or an evening works best. The cool. First session.
That's good equity is what that is.
Yes, exactly. and we have signups online. It's a free event, but we also want to provide childcare, interpretation, and transportation just to ensure that everyone who wants to be a part of this conversation can participate.
I think it's great. I think that you see it a lot in the community, either talking to people or especially on social media, I feel, where you know, folks are upset about inequality in different areas, even right here locally. And I think for folks that are feeling that way, it can feel very isolated, you know, like they're kind of in this on their own. So I think it's really cool to pull people together, get some leaders and some folks that, you know, have that skill set of being able to kind of shape the dialogue in a positive and constructive way and sort of create something that is not only helpful for those folks because they're not, you know, feeling isolated anymore, but also ultimately could produce some change in, you know, some larger change in our community.
Absolutely. And Frankie, I love that you use that word positive because I have seen a lot of places where these people have tried to bring up these topics and it doesn't seem positive. It seems accusatory. Gotcha. But what we're trying to do is make it that word positive because we all come at it from different places. And if we look at each other with through the lens of what does this person bring to the table? How can we collaborate and work together? It can absolutely be a positive, empowering experience for everyone involved, regardless of where you are in that spectrum of income inequality.
Sure, sure. Well, as a white cis man, I appreciate that because, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that I am attacked or anything like that, but I rarely, well, never, you know, have that inequality issue or can't really claim that because of my privilege. But I appreciate that this is something where I could walk into and sort of try and be a help or at least learn where other folks are coming from without feeling like I'm the bad guy. Because I certainly, however, you know, just being who I am might passively contribute to someone's problem. Like I certainly have never intentionally tried to, you know, wrong someone or anything like that. And I'm sure the same is true of most other folks like me. So
yes, absolutely. And yeah, I love that honesty too of just, hey, this is where I'm coming from and how can we collaborate and move forward and learn from one another too. What you brought up was huge because we all have things to learn from one another.
Sure, absolutely. Cool. Okay, well, tell us again. So it's going to be on Wednesday, December 4th.
Correct.
And the two sessions, 2 p.m. to 4:30. And then another one at 6, is that right?
Correct. And then we'll have a social hour in between, between 4:30 and 6. And that's just a great way for those interested on with connecting more with the local design labs, connecting with one another. We'll have food, chance to connect. But the sessions will be the afternoon at 2 and the evening at 6.
Awesome. Great. So we'll be putting the link out through our social media and stuff, but it's is simple enough to actually share. It's bit.ly/equityclackamas.
Correct. And you can see our overall website at clackamasprosperity.org.
Okay, cool. Anything to add before you go?
We would just love to have everyone in the community that's interested on even joining the conversation, even if you're not sure what exactly equity is, just come learn from alongside and with us. We would love to have you.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Joy. Appreciate you coming onto the show. It's, again, such a rare treat.
Thank you, Frankie. And this time I didn't even have a script that I had to remove puns from.
I know. You didn't even have to edit all my weird jokes, my dad jokes. So. Thanks, Joy.
No, it's been great. Thanks, Frankie.
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily, you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby. Letterbuck. Those three words may mean nothing to you or me, but they mean everything to a rodeo cowboy. They don't give meaning to his existence. They are the meaning of his existence. And those three little words float all the hopes and dreams, the pain and strife, the blood, sweat, and tears of every man who ever dared try to make a living in the dusty arenas from sun-kissed Wachula to icy Calgary. Those words mean something else, too. They speak a special message and the language known only by a few. Hey, cowboy. Those 20 hours you just spent in the back of a borrowed station wagon, that last home-cooked meal you had 3 weeks back, that little ache that you ignored until it was too late, and every other sacrifice you made and step you took to get here tonight, well, they don't mean a damn thing. Now, now is when you work. David Botham knows this. For a stretch of 5 years or so in the late 70s and early 80s, Botham was one of the country's greatest athletes you've never heard of. He was born and raised in Silverton with a stint here and there in other small towns. In the summer of 1977, he was living at the Three Rivers Ranch in Canby. He was 23 years old, 4 years into his professional rodeo career. He started on bucking horses when he was 16 and learned the trade from his uncles. He competed in high school rodeo and the amateur Northwest Rodeo Association before he hit the big time, breaking into the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association in 1973 at the age of 18. Peewee Rodeo, Little Britches Rodeo, Junior Rodeo, High School Rodeo, Intercollegiate Rodeo, and a host of other amateur associations feed into the PRCA. You make it there, and you're in with the big boys. The roughest competition in the world, the meanest, hardest bucking broncs and bulls, and the richest payouts of all. Botham cut an unusual figure in the rodeo world. Freckle-faced and sandy-haired, he had a playful, nonchalant air and more of a, sort of all-American boy than a driven athlete competing at the absolute pinnacle of his sport. He loved arcade games and would often blow off steam on long road trips with rounds of Pac-Man or Space Invaders. A favorite snack was a mixing bowl full of cold milk and Trix cereal, which he ate standing at the kitchen counter at home or on the road, wherever he happened to be. He harbored secret dreams of a second life as a country western singer and was known to suffer bouts of impromptu karaoke, singing along to Conway Twitwee on the radio with an empty Diet Pepsi can used for a microphone. Alas, as his wife and friends well know, that boy could not carry a tune. Professional rodeo was surging in popularity in the 1970s and 80s, driven by a host of factors. Their cumulative purses each year totaled in the tens of millions. They sold more tickets than the NFL. In the summer of 1977, Botham launched himself onto the national stage by being named the North American Saddle Bronc Champion. He claimed the title by winning in the world-famous Calgary Stampede in Canada, eh? It was an upset, to say the least. Botham entered the final round tied with future Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame Joe Marvel. But everything broke right for Botham that night, and in his final ride, he earned a perfect score, 100 out of 100. He went home to Canby with the trophy and the purse, $2,300, which is a little low even for those days. Marvel would go on to win the World Saddle Bronc Riding title the following year. It was also in 1977 that Botham suffered a devastating loss which would deeply impact him for the rest of his life and make him ride all the harder. It was the loss of his friend and traveling partner, Mick Whiteley, who died beneath a bull at Inglewood, Colorado. "We shared the goal of making the finals," he would later tell a reporter. "I knew how much he wanted to make it, and that's just made me want to get out there and do it more." And he got there. From 1978 to 1982, Botham ranked in the top 15 of nearly 2,000 PRCA saddle bronc riders, earning himself a berth at the National Finals Rodeo each year. In 1982, he ended the regular season ranked 7th in the world with winnings of nearly $30,000. He rode 100 rodeos a year in his prime, often competing 10 or 12 times a week, scattered over a half a dozen different states. In this business, this kind of schedule is called rodeoing hard, as opposed to rodeoing easy, which means 8-hour days in a car instead of 16 or 20, one rodeo a day instead of two or three. No one puts more hours into his work but gets paid for less time on the job than a rodeo cowboy. But eventually it caught up to him. It does to all athletes, of course, and rodeo cowboys have a shorter shelf life than most. Maybe it's the brutal schedule, driving thousands of miles every week. Maybe it's the stress. Rodeo cowboys get paid only if they win. If they get a bad draw or a bad break, they get nothing. Just better luck next time. Maybe it's the physical toll. In his day, Botham competed with a broken ankle, broken toe, torn knee, separated ribs. In the rodeo business, this is known as an injury-free career. Whatever the reason, Botham eventually retired to Eastern Oregon, where he became a contractor running his own home-building firm. And in 1988, he helped found the Farm City Pro Rodeo, which has grown into one of the central events in the region, drawing top cowboys from around the sport of rodeo and giving the small blue-collar community of Hermiston one of the best shows on dirt. Botham continues to serve the Farm City Rodeo Board to this day. Much of the material for this segment comes from a 1982 profile in the Oregon magazine by writer Teresa Jordan. We're grateful for her permission in allowing us to pilfer liberally from her excellent piece. For a link to her article, find this story on our website at canbenowpod.com.
Located just off the corner of 13th and South Ivy is one of the most magical places on Earth, Puddin' River Chocolates. That's where Chief Chocolatier Teresa Sassy and her team of employees hand-make some of the richest, most delicious gourmet chocolates you can find anywhere. Yeah, that's right. Willy Wonka wishes he was this good. Teresa uses the highest quality free trade cocoa from around the globe and locally sourced hazelnuts, berries, and other ingredients to create world-class confections that are a treat to the eyes and the taste buds. And they do more than chocolate. The classic fondue is an ideal blend of Swiss cheese, wine, and spices that you have got to try. Puddin' River's creations make a great gift for a loved one, or hey, for yourself, because you know what? You deserve it. I deserve it, Frankie! Find them at PuddinRiverChocolates.com. The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at NHTStudios.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
Huge thank you as well to our supporters on Patreon. We rely on your monthly contributions to continue to do this work that we seriously love. For information on how you can become one of the coolest people in the world, a patron of the Canby Now podcast, visit canbynowpod.com/plus.